Okay, hello everyone. We are so excited to chat with all of you today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're in person, which is really exciting.
Yeah. High five.
High five. Yes. We're in the same office. We wore dark colors just for this occasion. anyways, really excited to get started. I'm Leah. I'm the CEO of Tiller, and this is Martin. He's one of the best people I know in the talent space. We were lucky enough to work together at Coinsquare. And Martin is also the head of talent at Caseware and the founder of People Group, which I'm guessing a lot of you are probably a part of. And if you work in HR and talent and you're not, you should shoot us a message afterwards and we will make sure you get connected into the People Group. How many people are in there?
We're like 40 people away from 3,000.
Okay, so almost 3,000 people who work in the space. Great network to participate and ask about literally anything you want to know with people or talent. The group is really, really active. It's a Slack group. Anyways, I think we'll dive right into it. I have a lot of questions that I want to ask Martin, but if any of you have questions you want to ask, we've got the chat open. So type them in and we'll keep our eye on it. Awesome. So I think the first question, everyone's going to expect me to ask it. I hope there's a day where we don't talk about the post-COVID world anymore, but a lot has changed since the first lockdown in 2019. And, you know, I'm curious what you think the sort of best and worst outcomes are as they relate to HR and talent management. You know, I'm watching LinkedIn and people are like, if you don't allow your employees to work remote, you don't trust them. And I'm like, okay, like that's aggressive. But I think there are positive things that have come out of the remote work. There's also a lot of challenges. So would love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think the best thing that's come out of all of this is sort of the realization of companies and leaders as to like what people can accomplish remotely, right? And the number of tech companies that have thrived because they were able to like adapt and pivot to like a remote world quickly, and not perfectly, but quickly, is probably one of the most interesting things. And I think specifically like from a talent perspective, I think the joke I always make is like, you know, the Raptors never would have won the like championship if they could have only recruited players from Toronto, right? And I think a lot of companies are somewhat like limited to their local geographic area pre-pandemic. And so maybe that's the best thing, but it's also complicating a lot of things, right? In terms of now companies who used to hire locally are exploring other continents entirely. And so that has implications to like your local teams and has implications to the culture and just the overall like vibe that a company has. So I think that's probably the most interesting and best thing that has come out of all of this, because we all had the technology. Like Zoom existed, yes. before the pandemic, and nobody was really using it to its full potential. Maybe some companies were out of necessity given their like global size, but I think it really truly empowered smaller entrepreneurial people and companies to like recognize that there's an entire world to like hire talent from. And I think that's probably the best thing that came up.
Yeah. Yeah. Before you get to the worst, I think to take it one step further, one thing I think is the best is there were companies before the pandemic that had flexible work, but what flexibility meant was you could work from home some days. You're still expected to be sort of glued to your computer 9 to 5.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's caused by the fact that kids were not in school for so long. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the fact that people, you know, had to take care of their kids during the day, flexibility has a new meaning where it's now acceptable to say, I'm going to stop work every day at 3 o'clock. I'm going to go be with my kids. I'm going to come back on later on, mm-hmm. or I really need to take a mental health walk. I'm going to go. And so I think flexibility has a new meaning. And I think that's what people really need for balance, is to be flexible with their life, whatever that is, if it's a workout at 2 p.m. or if it's taking your kids to daycare. And I think that's one of the best things that I've seen.
No, I think that's like a really good point. And it kind of like highlights some of the solutions to one of the worst things about, you know, this post COVID situation. So like the, yeah, fully agree. Like I couldn't have said it better.
And what do you think the worst is?
I mean, for me, I think the worst part is really just like, well, first off, it's like folks' mental health, right? If you weren't in a position to deal with all the consequences of this, and maybe you relied on the people at your office on a day-to-day basis to sort of like fill your cup or energize you, that got taken away. So everybody had to adapt. And I think the worst part is just the overall shift that the entire world kind of had to go through. We're seeing that economically right now. Like we're in a recession. We're heading into a recession. There's a lot of challenges around that. A lot of people are, you see the layoffs on LinkedIn and Twitter on a regular basis, and then in your news feeds. And that's somewhat related to the pandemic. And it's, I think, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not an economist or anything like that, but I don't think we're out of the woods yet, given all the other implications there. And so like, yeah, like that's still happening. That's still real. And I think, you know, it kind of means that companies need to take advantage of what's good and what's the best situation out of all of this in order to navigate the worst part as well.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think mental health is such an important point. And not everyone wants to be fully remote. And I think now I'm seeing a lot of companies trying to accommodate both. I know I have a friend who works for Coursera, and she told me, like, I'm never going back to the office more than one day a week. And they didn't even really have an office here. And then she went in and she was like, oh, I really like being around people. And they actually just got an office here for their staff. And not that anyone's forced to go in, but that way for those who want that interaction, they can have it. And so I think now we need to sort of strike this balance.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting balance to like figure out, right? Even for myself, right? I'm like, I myself am benefiting from the fact that like there is some flexibility. Like I can say I'm going to go pick up my daughter from daycare or something like that at 3 o'clock. I have the ability to do that. That wouldn't have been an option. So my life would be so much more complicated previously. So like, even for myself, like that's something that I'm appreciating. But like, even on the mental health side, like if you can, there have been so many solutions that have come out of this that are just highlighting the importance of it as well, which I think is kind of a good sign.
I agree. I agree. Okay. So, you know, future of work, we keep hearing this sentence. It's going to be overused soon. I'm pretty sure. You know, I think this was actually a question that came in from someone who's attending, and they're curious to hear, like, what are your 3 to 5 strategies that you think are going to become key over the next 12 to 18 months as things still start to change, maybe settle a bit, but still change as they're settling? You know, what do you think are the 3 to 5 strategies people need to start thinking about now so that they can remain competitive and keep a good culture over the next year and a half?
Yeah. Well, I think you said it best in terms of flexibility. I think companies need to figure that out in terms of every company's figuring it out. There are companies that have existed and were already remote first and or hybrid prior to the pandemic, and maybe they figured it out for themselves. But I think, like much like many things in life, that's an experience you have to go through as an individual, or that's an experience a company has to go through as a unit or as a team, right? Where, so I would say figuring out what's important to your team now, what kind of culture you want your company to have, and then doubling down on the things that work and being iterative about it, treat it like a product, right? We've got a product in the market, and whether it's tech or even just an actual tangible physical product, and your customers are giving you feedback or your employees are giving you feedback on it. You want to double down on the things that are working, and you want to quickly like make shifts and changes to the things that are like, this doesn't serve us, or this doesn't give us hope. So I think flexibility is important. And so you would do that with, you know, sort of like cultural survey tools and stuff like that. And if you don't have budget for stuff like that, then you could just use a Google form. Yep. If you don't have budget for a Google form, then I have other questions. So that's one. I think another strategy is really kind of nailing down how you can kind of look at the rest of the world for your talent. I think there's, if you're building a product, for the sake of like this example, if you're building a product that's like specific to a geography, then yeah, maybe it makes sense to like stick to that geography. But if the ambitions are to build a company or a product that serves a continent or the world, then it actually benefits you early on to have folks with different perspectives, diverse perspectives on what the product could be. And that requires that you hire outside of sort of your main geography, right? Or where you're presently situated. I think if you're going to do well at that, so like that's number two, is like take advantage of like the global opportunity and the global talent market. And I think the third thing is like figure out working. So there's flexibility, international recruitment, global recruitment. And I would say like getting really good at asynchronous work. So if you can't be together as a team, how do you operate? And I think that's probably one of the bigger things, being challenged. Like leaders are being challenged to, how do I lead a team in this new environment? They haven't necessarily figured it out. I'm still figuring it out, right?
And do you think you need core hours where everyone is available together? You know, I had a dream of having one of these remote roles, and I was like, I'm going to live in a different city for 3 months and then come back to Toronto for 3 months and then go to a different city. But as I started looking up a lot of the remote roles, you actually generally have to be within a time zone. They're like, stay in North and South America, or you have to be in Europe. But I see other companies that are like, work from anywhere in the world, any hours you want. That just terrifies me, because sometimes it's like you want something done, but your designer is 12 hours ahead, and it can slow down the pace of work. So how do you think companies should address that piece of it?
Well, I think like any big behavioral change, you should take the approach of a light switch, you should take the approach of like a dimmer switch versus a light switch. Like if you've never done remote work, you can't just flick a switch and say, hey, we're remote now, we do all these things, we're going to be good at it. That's like going to the gym, being out of shape, and expecting that one session at the gym is going to, you know, all of a sudden, you know, sweet, I'm buff now. Like that's not going to happen. I wish. And so I think everything takes work. So like maybe there's this North Star that you want, that for whatever reason, you have this belief that this is how our company should operate. It should be completely asynchronous and nobody ever has a meeting and we can be in any time zone in the world. If that's what you want to do for whatever reason, work up to it. But definitely don't approach it from the like, hey, we're going to do this overnight or in 30 days or 6 months.
Yeah. That's good advice.
Yeah. For anything.
Yeah. Awesome. Should we go to an audience question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I love the conversation going on in here. Okay. There's something to be said about shoulder to shoulder learning, affiliations, and mentorship when you're in the office. Does an element of this go away when so many folks are remote consistently? I love this question. Mm-hmm. I talk a lot about this. And I think what I'll say is just two things before you answer. One, and I think it might be even in one of our other questions. So McKinsey actually released a study, and from April 2021 to April 2022, the number one reason people left their roles is lack of development. Mm-hmm. So, you know, employees want that mentorship, they want that development. And I think there is something to be said for like being in an open concept office and just seeing how someone works, even if you're not interacting with them. And the second thing is, this is actually a big thing that, again, I talk a lot about LinkedIn, but I spend a lot of time on there. There obviously is a different type of connection. And I think you are always going to lack in mentorship a little bit. So yeah, really, really curious what you think about this one.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Roxy, Nathan, Ash.
I think this Julia, one came from Julie. Yeah.
I recognize all your names. So good to see you. Thanks for dropping by. I think, yeah, at the end of the day, there's definitely that benefit of having, you know, even with our time at CoinSquare, I learned a lot from just being able to see how you operate. And just, I learned a lot from seeing how you operate in, you know, executive meetings and stuff like that. And there was like, oh, I'm going to put that in my pocket and use it another time. And I think that's hard to replace. So you're right. There's, with any decision, there's pros and cons, there's trade-offs that you're going to have to make. I think, you know, being so remote and going to like a more remote world, I think it kind of should remind an individual that like mentorship shouldn't just come from your workplace. I think, and mentorship, and this is something I say all the time, is like, I have 100+ mentors, myself personally. I wouldn't be the person that I am today had I not, you know, learned how to sell from someone like 15 years ago, or had I not, you know, gotten feedback from, you know, a boss about being on time for my shift and stuff like that. Like those are mentorship moments. And then you have mentors that will ebb and flow and come and go throughout your entire life. But I think if your mindset is that mentorship needs to come from my workplace, then you're actually looking in a place where it's least likely to come from, I think, especially the most valuable mentorship I've always found personally. And, you know, I'm biased on this, so it's my experience. I found the most valuable mentorship has come from people outside of where I work in that moment. Maybe it's somebody that's moved on, but that, at least that's sort of my take.
Do you think there's a difference though for like overall mentorship? Like what's my next career move? You know, how did you get from point A to point B? Like for that, I agree. Outside mentorship usually is what ends up being good. But when you're talking about mentorship, small things, like I'm trying to learn how to do these four formulas in Excel, or I'm trying to get better at how to properly use Notion or Jira, like that, also that really like high touch mentorship, maybe that's more coaching.
Yeah.
How do you see that part being replaced? And you're right, you can still go to outside mentors. I mean, we're trying to kick off marketing at Tiller, and you can bet me and Alicia are, you know, calling on everyone we know and getting advice from them. But we're a small company. You know, I think at CoinSquare, if I had like an HR issue or talent issue, you know, there's people you can go to. So do you think there's like a differentiator between what would be good for an inside company mentor and what would be good for an outside company mentor?
Yeah. So if like inside company mentor, at the end of the day, you're probably showing some, like if it's intentional, you're probably showing someone something on a screen.
Right.
Right.
That's fair.
And if it's not something on a screen and it's something to witness, then maybe you jump. So for example, we've got a new person on our team starting this week. My goal and ask for her and the rest of the team is that jump in on as many calls as you can to see how everybody does things differently, but also notice the things that they all do the same from a process perspective. So there is no loss to me personally, in terms of, at least from what I can perceive, in terms of like, what do they absorb? Do they lose out on, you know, the things that they could pick up randomly just like sitting beside each other? Yes, but I think the solution to it is like just being more intentional. And if you're a person that needs mentorship or wants mentorship, I think the only difference in a more remote world is just having to advocate for yourself more and saying, putting up your hand and saying, I'd like you to show me how to do this, and that'll just help just in general. Yeah.
That's great. And, you know, we have mentorship matching in our platform, and 9 out of 10 times when we show it to someone, we get asked the question, does this match only internally or does it match externally? So there is a big big desire for people to be matched externally to mentors. So maybe one day. Awesome. So, I mean, you've had a very successful career in recruitment. I'd say you're the most successful recruiter I know, but I might be biased because we work together. But you're awesome either way. I'm guessing you've recruited like hundreds or thousands of people. And I know working with hiring managers can be challenging. So once Martin came to me and said, your interviews are too short. You're embarrassing my recruiters. And I was like, okay, yeah, you know, need to have a minimum. So like, you're really good at working with hiring managers and coaching them. You know, what advice would you give to everyone on this call who's doing recruiting that is struggling with hiring managers? Either their interviews are too short, or maybe they're not responding quick enough, or I'm guessing they give you requirements and you give them 10 candidates with those requirements and they're like, oh, but I want these things. Like, what's the best way to make sure that process is smooth and efficient? Because obviously speed is important for hiring and candidate experience is really important for hiring as well.
Yeah, no. Yeah, fully agree on all those points. I mean, there will never not be a difficult hiring manager. Like if you're a recruiter, you're working with a difficult hiring manager and you're working with amazing hiring managers. Working with you was awesome. And yeah, I gave you some feedback, but you also gave me some feedback. And I think like the example that like you and I, like the experience that we had together was that it was a partnership.
Right.
And like, seems like a cliche word to say, but I think if you find yourself struggling with a hiring manager, almost take a step back and identify, is this a service center model where you're bringing in your car, you've got a broken, you know, your tire, you've got a flat tire, and you're just going to the recruiter saying, fix my flat tire. I'm using an analogy, obviously, because recruiters can't, well, maybe some can, but you get my point. Like, whereas a partnership is like, hey, we are all invested in the success. I'm hopefully, I'm going to use a term or an analogy that you appreciate here, but like Formula One, like a partnership is you've got a driver, they're driving the car, and you've also got a pit crew that's going to assess and give you feedback and say, hey, this is, and it's a constant form of communication, right? So clearly I don't have like a super intimate relationship with my mechanic when my like tire is flat or something, I can go and get it fixed. But if I'm recruiting and it's a long-term mission to build a great team, then you absolutely need to partner with your hiring manager. So if you're struggling, you probably don't have a partnership. And if you're still trying to partner, then it becomes like a question of like philosophical like differences. Do you have fundamentally different beliefs? There's like power dynamics at play as well. Like maybe a hiring manager has been with the organization for 10 years and you've just joined and it's you're only there for 6 months or something, like, or you've only been there for 6 months. Well, then that becomes, you know, your goal there is to earn their trust. How do you earn their trust? High frequency of communication, like dedication to like figuring out what it is that like is important to them when hiring, also educating them like, hey, did you know that like this person that you missed out on is actually solid? So getting to the level of being able to push back when a hiring manager says like, I don't want to meet this person for whatever reason, and truly identifying the reason why. So if you seek to understand, which I think is like some business help book, I forget which one, Robert Cleary or something like that. But like, if you seek to understand the person you're working with, you're going to build a partnership. But if you're just like, oh, person X said this and person, you know, and I need to help them, I'm just going to do the thing that they ask, then it's not a partnership, right?
I think you nailed it. And I think if there's any hiring managers on the call, I mean, you need to trust the recruiter. It's just like when I go to the hairdresser and I'm like, I want my hair to be blonde. I'm not like, use this color dye. I'm like, you tell me,
yeah.
Like, you know, so I'm not going to get into the details because that's not my expertise. So hiring managers should definitely be making sure they're doing that. And I think the thing that always surprises me is when it comes to sales, your leaders will, like, especially your C-level leaders, they'll get involved in sales. They have a connection. You want an intro, they'll reach out. You want them to come to a customer meeting, they're into it. But when it comes to recruiting and bringing new employees into the company, which is arguably the most important thing to do, we don't see the C-levels engaged. So I think another interesting thing would be get them engaged the way they're engaged in sales, and get your leaders, all your leaders, to be partners. I know back in the day, you told me sometimes when you see recruiter or talent in the title, devs won't write back. And so I dedicate an hour of my day just sending messages to developers. Like it should be a partnership. And so I think you said it very well. And just thank you again. I see there's so much discussion going on in the group. I Joanne, I really like your comment. I think that is very funny and probably also very true. Awesome. And again, if anyone has questions, I will ask them, but I love the discussion as well. So as a CEO of a company that's in what I'll call the skills tech space, which I don't think is fully caught on yet, but I think it's coming. I know Josh Burson is really pushing it. You know, I have to ask at least one question about skills. So do you believe organizations should move to being skills first? And when I say skills first, it's, you know, you're looking at skills versus, not totally versus experience, but you're looking at the skills someone's gained. Maybe you don't necessarily care where those skills came from. Did they come from job experience? Did they come from volunteer experience? Did they come from life experience? You know, do you think there's going to actually be a move to being more skills driven? And, you know, what do you think the advantages and disadvantages will be?
Well, I mean, I know Adam in the chat will agree with me, but I think like recruiting and hiring is fundamentally broken from in the first place, yeah. Right? And so that's why I love the fact that like Tiller and other companies exist, because they're calling the process or the act of hiring people out and trying to make improvements upon it. And so I think, yes. Yeah, I think there has to be a focus on skills. Like if you go to any social media platform, the things that are highlighted, it like at the very top from the very beginning is a picture of the person and their name. And I mean, you're talking to a biased person, and I mean that as a pun, but like a few friends and myself started like a Chrome extension called Unbiasify. And the whole point was like to eliminate the photo and to eliminate the person's name from their LinkedIn profile so that you can look at that person's work history in a more objective way, because their unconscious bias exists. It's going to creep into the process. So I think the more that a company can get aligned towards focusing on skills and just truly being objective and equitable in the recruitment process, the better your organization, the better your team's going to be, the better the company's going to perform. All the data is there. Unfortunately, I can't memorize McKinsey stuff and research stuff like that. I don't have like a laundry list, but like it's all there. Google it, takes 2 seconds, and you can find it. But so I think the problem with that is that the process that exists right now has been around for so long. Like resumes have not changed apart from like the font and the paper for over 100 years.
So is the resume dead?
I would hope so, but it's not. It's not going to, right? Kind of going back to like that light switch, dimmer switch kind of analogy, disruption doesn't happen overnight. Like in theory, Uber should have like completely wiped out the taxi market, but taxis still exist. They're still Uber there. Uber
still hasn't made any money.
That's wild. Yeah. So like that in itself means we're still going to have resumes.
Right.
Resume's not going to die, but there are better ways to do things. And I think that from a candidate experience perspective, people will flock to places that are trying to do in a progressive, fair, objective, equitable way. And if you're a startup, maybe you're not working on like the sexiest problem out there, but if your hiring practice highlights that you're focused on what actually matters versus so-and-so, you know, went to the same school as me, I'm just going to be, you know, hyper-focused on all the assumptions that come with that. Whether or not they can actually do the job is a different story. Yeah, I'm 1000% like companies should focus on assessing people from whether or not they can do the thing. I mean, I've said a lot here. I'll take a quick, like, if you looked at my profile, you wouldn't say Martin's got community management experience, right? No actual formal, but I've been managing a community for 6 years. So in theory, I could jump into any community manager role, but that's not my title and it wouldn't come across on my resume. That's unfair.
Yes.
And so that just highlights the fact that resumes are broken. That highlights the fact that the way people sort and review resumes in the first place is broken and biased and all that fun stuff. And so then it becomes a thing where I need to actively promote the things that I'm good at. And like, this is why I'm good at these things.
Yeah. I think, you know, we talk so much about diversity and inclusion, but how can we ever truly move towards being a diverse and inclusive society if we aren't looking at the experiences people have outside of work and the skills they've gained from that? Your example is great. I mean, you're running an insanely amazing community. And if someone's like, oh, but that wasn't your job title, I'm not considering this experience, I mean, their loss. It's just crazy. We had someone who did a demo for our product. And because we don't tell you the company, like we're really telling you skills only, you know, they said to us, we only hire from Shopify. And, you know, it was at point of audiences and we hung up from the call and I said, well, we don't want them because they don't get it. Mm. Right. Only hiring from Shopify. I mean, that's crazy.
You're missing out on so much great talent. Applying like a particular company for one particular reason, then you're competing against all their perks and benefits, right? So maybe that's feasible for some companies. It's definitely not feasible for the majority of companies. Yeah.
Okay. I see we have a couple questions in here. So what do you think about doing assessments and interviews, which are unpaid? Excellent question. I've seen some really heated debate on LinkedIn about this one. So yeah, excited to hear what you think.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I've done 5, 10 years more in the tech space. Like I've gone through the process of doing like an exercise. Reality is if I've got 5 or 10, and I'm speaking more on the developer side because like the numbers and the volume doesn't necessarily exist for all professions. But if I've got 10 opportunities on my plate and 2 of them are ones that I really want for whatever reason, if those 2 give me, you know, some form of an assessment to like a take-home assessment, I don't know if that's what Ash was referring to, but we can kind of talk about both sides. You're only going to have so much time, right? The take-home assessment is anywhere from like an hour to 4 hours, depending on the wildness of the recruitment process. But that's going to limit a talent acquisition team in terms of the quality of the candidates, because some folks just don't have that time.
So they're talking about take-homes.
Yeah. All right. I think if... it also doesn't feel like progression for a candidate, right? Like if you send me an assignment, that feels like a lazy way of assessing whether or not I can do the job versus do you actually want me to work for your organization? Let's have a conversation about it. Let's make that a part of the interview process. So I think you're going to lose out on talent that's just not feeling like things are progressing. And so, yes, that means you need to assess your talent and take time to do it, which is costly. But if you're in a aggressive hiring mode, the most important thing you can do is make sure that the people you're bringing into your organization meet the qualifications for what you're doing. There's cool tools out there to help you assess talent. I'm speaking more from like a tech company kind of perspective.
Yeah.
There's interesting, you know, companies that like, you know, you've got code, like DevSkiller, Code Academy, those things exist for developers. And the feedback I've always heard from developers is like, it doesn't feel like progression. Unless you're my like top pick, I'm not going to do it. So you lose out on the candidate in the first place. So if you are in a position to be, if you are an Amazon or a Facebook or a Google, in theory, there's enough volume of candidates heading your way that you can employ that strategy without being too worried, because the people that truly want to work there will fight there. That's not most people's challenge. That's not most recruiting teams' challenge. Most recruiting teams have a challenge of not enough candidates applying. And when they do, they're not necessarily qualified and you haven't been able to assess that properly. Kind of going back to the importance of being able to assess skill properly. Yes, 100%.
Yeah. And I think the right assignment, to your point, it should be one that both helps the company assess how you're going to do something, but also helps you assess the role in the company and whether it's a fit. So I think if you're getting a take home, it's 30 minutes to maybe an hour. And in that process, you're getting to know the company better. You're getting to know the role better. Maybe you're getting to know some of the people in the company better. You get to ask some good questions. That to me is a worthwhile assignment. But I've seen assignments where I once had a 30-minute informational interview with the CEO and then got an email that was like, you're one of five candidates to do this assignment. It should take you 4 hours. And I'm like, this is an 8-hour assignment. I don't know if I want this job yet. And the assignment was free work for them. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know, respectfully, I'm bowing out of this process. So I think, like, does the assignment also benefit the candidate in the process? Is it short? Great. If you're trying to get someone to do free work, I think this is where, you know, it doesn't work out.
Yeah, no, fully agree. I think if you look at the soft costs of recruiting and like how much time is being spent to interview a person, paying someone to do an exercise to confirm that they've got the skills you need is a minimal cost to double check that, you know, they're bringing to the table what you need, especially if you especially if you can't assess their talent or you're having trouble. Like oftentimes startups will run into like, we don't have a person here who can assess this person properly. And like, we don't know if you're great at marketing. Everything you've said was great. And then it becomes like a conversation, like that person was, you know, they were able to tell a great story. And they joined and guess what? It didn't work out for whatever reason. So I think that's when you kind of tap people in your own network on the shoulders and say, hey, how do you hire for this role? And you educate yourself. And maybe that's not the recruiter doing that. Maybe that's the hiring manager saying, hey, listen, I got to hire a social media manager. I have no clue. I don't even have a Facebook account. What do? That's where you kind of level yourself up if you don't have a recruiter kind of doing that.
Yeah. The last thing I'll caution against, just to anyone out there, is I've seen companies give assessments, getting people to answer scenarios based on things that have actually happened in the company. And so you give someone two lines and ask them to make a judgment, but you actually know the decision that was made in the company. And the candidate's going to fail every time because they don't have as much information as you. And, you know, you want them to give your answer versus just trying to figure out how they handle things. And so that's something I definitely advise never doing. Okay, I see we now have another question. Does this apply to the recruitment process of students and recent graduates, or is there a different process for them altogether, still relating to the assessments?
The problem of how do you get experience without work experience? I mean, there's some interesting tools out there. Ripen exists. They've got a cool product where it kind of democratizes the process and makes the process of getting experience easier, which is cool. I think, you know, assessing, there's less pressure to ensure that you're making the right decision for a company when you're hiring a student or a recent graduate, right? So I think the further down the line you go in terms of seniority or leadership within an organization, the more difficult the recruitment process typically is or should be. So I would say there should be some like form of assessment, right? Because if you're not assessing people on a skills-based level or like an objective technical level, then really what are you assessing a person on? Just how well the, you know, 4 hours of conversation went, 3 hours of conversation went. Like if I think forgetting the seniority, and Justin, to your point, forgetting the seniority of the individual, it's like how are you scoring whether or not this person is a good candidate for your organization? Because if you don't have a clear understanding of what that is from the beginning, then the experience is just going to highlight that in the first place.
Totally. Okay, this is a question someone submitted in advance. What are you doing to future-proof your employee retention, engagement, experience strategy?
Come again, sorry?
What are you doing to future-proof your employee retention and engagement and experience strategy?
Yeah. I think future-proofing is kind of interesting. And I would say specific to like what we're doing at Caseware right now, it's actually kind of like a really exciting time for us because we've undergone like transformation across the board with regards to like basically every department, and we're really kind of modernizing how we approach everything. So in terms of like future proofing and engagement, I think one of the things that we're doing is really just like bringing to the table, you know, a lot of best practices that haven't been in place beforehand. And so again, that's not a light switch, that's a dimmer switch. And the dimmer switch takes like forever, like years to like go from like, there's no light in the room to like, yes, I can see everything and everything's like crystal clear to me. You know, behavioral change and like cultural change and like just change management transformation overall, that's not a 1 month sprint. That's not, you know, 8 week sprints. That's years, right? So I think some of the things we're looking at, and that's probably the most impactful to us because we're expanding globally, is like making sure that how we integrate with some of the companies that we acquire is seamless and really sharpening up on that side of things. And then on top of that, I would say is like really nailing down like what the flexible work and hybrid work experience looks and feels like. So it's like inclusive to everybody, inclusive to all the global partners and companies that we have as a part of us.
Yeah. And I think when it comes to retention, like people want to see honesty, transparency, want to see growth and development. Like I wish there was some magic tool that was like, use this and you can retain, but it's so many factors altogether. Okay, I think this is an important one. There are so many layoffs right now. You and I have been through watching layoffs together at CoinSquare. It is hard. Mm. It is hard, obviously, when you're laid off, but it's also hard when you remain. I imagine it's especially hard if you're remaining on a talent team or an HR team. So what advice would you give to people who remain, who are still recruiting into a company that's done these large layoffs, or in an HR team who's trying to keep the people who are still there motivated?
Yeah, lots of sort of unpack there, but I would say the most important thing that I found, and I'm not sitting here saying that like we went through the experience perfectly, but the thing that people mentioned and reached out to me was that like if you're lucky enough to necessarily remain, make a big portion of, you know, the next few months dedicated to supporting folks that have been impacted. That doesn't matter who you are or what team you're on. I think, you know, if the business is going through something like that and it impacts a lot of people, make sure you're supporting them in some way, because that is what folks will remember. That's what folks will appreciate. It's not a positive situation in any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the best thing you can do as a leader, is to find ways to support people above and beyond, you know, an exit package or something like that. In terms of like staying motivated and staying engaged, I mean, when you go through that experience, it's jarring, right? Especially if you didn't see it coming. And so I think like everybody always does the like takes a step back and like, well, I'm still here. What do I do? Is this the right place for me? Do I agree with how it was done? And I think that's probably the most important thing for executives and senior HR and recruitment leaders, is to like, how is this done? Because if it wasn't done well, then you've just put your entire organization at risk, or a majority of it. You'll probably see more attrition than you'd like to see. So being thoughtful and conscious of factoring in the human side of things, mm-hmm. when you have to make a difficult business decision like that, then, and I think the other thing is to recognize, how did you get there in the first place? What led you? There's a lot of conversation and chatter going on right now in terms of, like, there was this heyday in the VC space where it's just like raising funds shouldn't and necessarily equate to, we're going to double the team, right? Do you actually need to double the team? Do you have the revenue to support that team that you want to hire 2-3 years down the road? Or are you just taking a new credit card that you got and maxing it out, right?
I think we've seen that companies that have goals of, we're going to have 100 employees by this date and 200 by this date. Yeah. I mean, employee goals never make sense. The employee hiring goals and the goals of which skills you're bringing in should always align to the needs of the company. Mm-hmm.
I think kind of going back to sort of like the worst and best things, I think one of the best things out of the pandemic and therefore like the shift that we're seeing in the entire space, we're probably going to see a lot more companies become conscious of hiring forecasts and how budget is being used and deployed in a way that will highlight mm-hmm. folks. It will hopefully folks learn from this. I'm sure there will be companies that will just double, triple, quadruple and scale. If that's needed, great. But I think one of the things that folks tend to forget when they're doing something like that is anytime you add a human being to a company, you add complexity. And if you do a lot of that all at once, you've just got a ton of potential chaos. If you do it well, great. But I think there's something to be said for like scaling a little bit slower, being a little bit more organic, even bootstrapping, or maybe not taking like from the smaller HR tech companies that I'm talking to, everybody's talking about going to slow it down, going to be a bit more organic, going to be a bit more thoughtful versus we're going to take all this money and we're going to solve all these problems, because adding people adds complexity.
Agreed. Okay, I'm going to ask one more question, and I think we have time for one more from the audience if someone wants to type one in there. We got it quick. Let's go to mine and then we'll go to the audience. So, you know, as we talk about retention being a struggle and companies trying to be leaner, it becomes increasingly important to make sure that as you are doing training and upskilling for people, that it's actually aligned to the needs of the company. And I think what we see in a lot of tech companies is training as a perk. Everyone has $1,000, then you can basically go do whatever you want. Some companies are a little more thoughtful and you have to get things approved. But even then, sometimes it's approved with, you know, your job title versus approved where the company needs. So anything you've seen companies do that you think really helps to align the training to the upcoming needs of the company? And I feel like you're going to have a good answer because you're one of the few recruiters I've worked with who was always thinking about what are the future needs we're going to have. And so how do you bring all that together?
It's tough. Learning and development is tough. Like I don't appreciate you thinking I'm going to have a good answer. I think like to anticipate what the organization needs. And from a learning, like the easy thing to do, easier in what often happens in the traditional model of learning and development, is setting aside a budget for each individual employee and saying, here's, and then finding a partner and saying, this is what you need. I've never seen like heavily directed, like you need to do this. I have seen sort of like, let's limit your learning and development to something that will benefit the organization.
Yeah, I think it's a balance.
Right? Yeah. I think first off, it has to be self-directed to a certain extent, because yes, if you're asking someone to spend time out of their day working on learning something new, it should be something that they enjoy. And it should be something that aligns with like what their career goals are that they can't get from someone internally.
Absolutely.
Right. I'm for my team, I've got a team of 8 people at the moment and soon to be 9. It's every person has a completely different career path that they want to go on. Like some, you know, let's, if you bucket it, maybe a few of them are interested in leadership.
Yep.
Maybe a few of them are interested in like, but you know, another person's interested in like project management. I never would have thought that, but that's important for that individual to just put their hand up and say, that's something I want to do. So rather than me saying, okay, well, here's $1,000, go to like a project management budget. Like, how can I help you assess if that's the right decision or not for yourself? Right. Because if it's, you know, if it's $500 or $1,000, then you're kind of limited. It's not like you're not going to get your master's, you're not going to get a PhD right. in the thing that you want, but you do also want to support the individuals from a, you know, a growth perspective. I think that budget kind of is like, it makes it easy, and almost folks kind of like utilize it in a lazy way. Whereas like, if you have a good, I would say the best way to go about it is making sure that your leaders, know the importance to whomever, let's say the C-suite or the founders and the executives, making sure that they encourage all of their leaders to take an active role in you know, ensuring that somebody's career growth is going in the direction they want. Because oftentimes folks don't really know. You know, you get a job and you find out you're good at something, and then you do it for 6 years, and then, you know, 8 years later you wake up and you're like, what am I doing? Why yeah. am I selling nuts and bolts?
I just read Think Again by Adam Grant. Mm. And I admit it wasn't my favorite book, but one thing he said that I really liked was, if we start asking kids from the age of like 2 or 3, what do you want to be when you grow up? And then you start getting in your head, well, I'm going to be a teacher, I'm going to be a lawyer. And then you start working towards that, and then you get there and you're like, I don't even like this. So I think trying to identify, is what this person says they want to do actually something they're going to enjoy? Like, that's what makes a really good leader, or a really good HR leader, really good talent leader, is, you know, is this what they want to do? So that's a really good point.
And I would say, like, probably one of the least assessed things that I've seen throughout my career is good leadership, which is crazy. And how do you assess that on paper, right? Just because I lead a team of 8 people doesn't mean I'm a good leader. In theory, it's like, sure, the company's trusted me to lead 8 people or 9 people or whatever. Yeah. Does that mean I do a good job of it? How do you even express that on paper, right?
I wish the world had an answer to that one, because I think bad leaders are like a really big problem. I think they are the leading cause. I don't have McKinsey stats on this one. This is just my gut, but I think that's the leading cause of that culture. And that's from personal experience. And like, if you don't genuinely care about the success of others, don't be a people leader, like, just full stop.
Yeah.
It has to drive you. Okay. So our last question is, return to office. Any practical tips to get people to come in? Do you want me to go what you think, since we have people that come into our office?
Yeah.
Well, I asked myself the question, so apologies. But so at Tiller, we come into the office twice a week on Mondays and Wednesdays. And how we landed there was, I surveyed the team. I said, hey, what do you guys want? How many days do you want to come in? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. I surveyed on the days of the week. And honestly, people were pretty flexible with Mondays and Wednesdays. And after we had been doing it for about 8 weeks, I went back and I said, do you want to change anything? Do you want to come in less? Do you want to come in more? And every single person wanted to keep things the way it was. My only suggestion I got was, hey, can you add a team lunch once a month? And I was like, yeah, of course. So now we're doing a team lunch once a month. We always have these are minor things. They're pretty flaky, I guess. But we have bubbly in the fridge. We have like 7 flavors all the time. The team loves bubbly. We go through a lot of coffee. We have fun with our snacks. You know, we're always asking people, what do you want? And we buy fun things. And we just created, I think, this space where people feel more productive, not just when they're in the office, but throughout their whole week, because they got to have those touch points. But, you know, the most important thing is just, you have to make sure you kind of get some buy-in up front. And I think Martin's Dimmer example is also pretty good here, is, you know, I wouldn't go to 5 days a week, you know, and depending on your team and where they live. For us, we're very lucky. Everyone lives almost within walking distance of our office, with the exception of a few people. So it was a bit of an easier sell. But if you have people that have moved to like Waterloo and Hamilton and Niagara, you know, it might be a different story. But I would say, like, use the Dimmer approach and try to get buy-in. But I'll also say it could be dangerous to try to get buy-in, because if people are all over the map, it might be hard to figure out what to do. But if you can get it, I think that's a great place to start. don't know if you have anything.
No, I mean, those are awesome tips. I would ask the question, like, what's the problem you're trying to solve? I know that's super cliche. I've just given you a classic non-answer, Nathan, so my apologies. But like, if you go to, it's why do you want more folks to come in? Like, what is the core of, like, why do you, because that will indicate the solution, right? And so if the problem you're trying to solve is like, folks aren't sharing, you know, innovative ideas, well, do you have a Slack channel dedicated to like innovative ideas, or what is the incentive? And I think, you know, from a kind of going back to like changing a person's behavior or encouraging change in behavior, it's how do we incentivize people to do it? And, you know, having availability of like, you know, snacks and flexibility is important, but I think, and Leah, I haven't said anything new, so just take Leah's answer and run with it. But like, I would just underline your answer of like doing it collaboratively is the most important thing. Because if it is something that is top down, or it's just, hey, we wrote this new policy, everybody's coming, and you've got a ticking time bomb there. Whereas like, why do we want more people coming to the office? Explain that. Because if people understand why you want them to come into the office, then they can buy into the, whether or not they agree with that concept in general. And then it becomes, well, how do we solve this problem? It becomes an actually great exercise for the entire company to like bond over, engage over, and say, well, we want to get to this point. This is why. Do we all agree? Yes, this is important. How do we solve it? And then it becomes a problem the company solves that is unrelated to like launching their product in 2 months or something. And it just becomes a good cultural experience.
That was great. And you finished exactly at 2:00. So good timing. Thank you everyone for joining. Thank you, Martin, for your time. And you know, we do these events once a month. So if there's anything you want to see from Tiller, drop us a line. And we want to build content that everyone enjoys. So thank you again for your time and for all the comments. One of my favorite parts of this session. Have a good day, everyone.
See you. Thanks.